So tonight is December 30th or December 29th?
January 1st is Tuesday.
So today is the
29th. Today is the 29th, and this is the fifth lecture. Fifth lecture, I believe this is, of this season. This is 1500s in Europe. And tonight I thought we would start with Poland. Okay, so Poland is, the Jews have very, very fond memories of Poland. I mean, except, as great as it was in Poland, the Holocaust was just wiped that all out. But they all say there was like a golden age of Poland for about really 150 years. But Poland was always very opening. They were very welcoming to the Jews up until, more modern history. We're going to talk about that later, starting with the Gezeirat Tachvatat, with Khmelnytsky's uprising. But even after that, it wasn't so bad. Then eventually when Russia came in, then things started going bad. But Poland was known as, the word Poland, they would say, is Polin. Here we will rest. And a lot of the, we'll go through it, and then hopefully, and I don't think I'll get to it tonight, the next future lectures of a lot of the learning that are done in yeshiva today are from the Polish scholars. And so there was a tremendous time when everything was working very, very well in Poland. One other thing I was saying, okay, if I remember myself, okay, this is more like what today's Poland is. It's between Germany and Russia, the Czech, Slovakia, okay. I guess we start in the beginning, just like a brief history. Jews started coming after the First Crusade. The First Crusade in 1096 to 1098, they started going through Europe, and as they were going through Germany, they were destroying. It was like bands of people, and they'd come to a town, and they would just destroy the town. They'd go from town to town as they were going east towards the Holy Land. There was, again, two types of crusades. One were the nobles, but those were the ones that they booked ahead. They had the hotels, you know, they had the, everything was all set up for them, but it was the people's crusade that they didn't, you know, book any, they didn't have, they were walking, and they would just go from town to town. They were hungry, and they would just rob, steal, and do worse things. Okay, so that was the first time that some Jews started to come to Europe, and Boleslaw, if I'm saying his name correctly, he was very tolerant. He encouraged, he realized early on that when you have Jews there, it's economically advantageous for your country. This was Poland around the 1100s. It was a nice sized kingdom. You know, it wasn't like today we look at it, it's rather small, and it was pushed over a little bit. But this was the German Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, France, Spain, England. It looks like in the 1100s, the size of Poland was just about the size of Spain and or England. It was a nice sized country. Okay, this is just a different picture of it. All right, so the Jews, as they were there in the 1100s, 1200s, they had peace basically, and they were part of the middle class. And the Polish nobility, they acknowledged that the Jews were there. They were protecting of the Jews. It was, you know, the Jews were economically making things better for them. Also, you have to realize the Jews, they don't fight back. You know, it's not like, you know, tomorrow you're going to turn around, they're going to get themselves an army and overtake the country. It was never a fear that this everything would happen. So, you know, Jews were you never had to worry about them any type of attacking. just very interesting in this week's Parsha, right?
That was
Paris Tina. Well, maybe they'll join up on our enemies. Maybe back then the Jews were a little bit of a different stock. I don't know. But or maybe it was just really an excuse, you know, because, you know. But the truth is, through up until, you know, through the years that the Jews were in Eretz Yisrael, they took up arms. They weren't shy about, you know, fighting. But in Gullis, overall, it never was a Jewish army. It just never, that wasn't part of the Jewish way of fighting. Maybe a little in Spain, but not as a nation. They were part of the Spanish army. Okay, so the Jews were the middle class. Now, what are some of the reasons why Poland was very attractive for the Jews? One thing came from something called the Magdeburg Rights. Now, the Magdeburg Rights was a set of rights that was set up for towns and cities, and it was set up by Otto. Otto the First, he was the Holy Roman Emperor all the way back then, from 936 to 973, and it regulated the decree. Each city and village had a certain amount of autonomy, that the cities and villages could determine what rules, you know, ordinances, you know, what they wanted to set up for their own towns. And that was set up in the Holy Roman Empire, that every town can do this for themselves. It was called the Magdeburg Rights. And it helped for Poland, because the Magdeburg Rights, it gave some sort of a charter to the Jews, that the Jews could, when they came to Poland, they could, first of all, they could define their neighborhoods. They have certain economic conditions, competitors, they could do their economics, they could find jobs, businesses, and also set up monopolies. And it made Jewish people one, and in communities, it was very attractive for them to go there. Especially, well, as we're going to see, in the 1100s, that was the beginning of persecution of Jews in Europe. Before the Crusades, it really did not happen. It wasn't, you know, the Jews and the non-Jews got along very well, relatively, but basically well, and things, that all changed with the Crusades. Then the Jews looked at the Goyim differently, the Goyim looked at the Jews differently, and then for the next hundreds of years, it just evolved out of that. Also, the princes were very, very good, determined protectorates. They wanted the Jews in, they were willing to protect. Again, like all the other structures in Europe, you had your nobles and princes, and they owned land, and basically most of the people there were serfs. Most of the people there were serfs. So you had the landowners, the wealthy landowners, the wealthy princes, and down on the bottom you had the serfs. And the Jews would somehow fit in. They never were in a class system, but they were somehow fit in as the middle class. They were also the, I think it's called the Araners. They were the ones that managed the land for the Polish nobles. And this was all through the years. For hundreds of years, the Jews are going to be the ones to do that. So you'd have an absentee Polish noble or prince or landowner that wasn't there. The estate was managed by the Jew. And he was the one that had to make sure that the serfs were planting, or paying their taxes, doing whatever that had to be done. Okay, Polish law. So there was another Polish law, later Polish law also, that was very protecting of the Jews. The point is, to the amount that in 1264 he ordered a general charter of Jewish liberties, and it was especially for the Jews. And he came out with, again, 1264. This is like, you know, after 200 years of Europe and the Jews being, you know, persecuted. So here in Poland, they got the freedom of worship, trade, travel, and these privileges went to the Silesian Jews by different princes. I'll show you where Silesian is. Silesian is like southwest of Poland, or where Poland was, that region too, very close to Germany. And this was very, very attractive. It was very It was something to attract the Jews to Poland. Okay, however, on the other hand, you had the churches. Now, the church, of course, that was not what was going through their mind. They were not interested in furthering the Jewish, rights. So they did everything they could to stop the Jews' rights, all the liberties and everything. So these councils, councils of, I can't even say it, Rocklaw? Well, what is this? Does anybody know what that is? No. But, all right, Rocklaw, Buddha, okay, they came out with their laws or decrees is that it should be that the Jews should be segregated, they should have to wear a special emblem, they should be banned from holding offices that there are non-Jews or Christians that are below them, and also forbade them, that's it, one shul every city, that's it, no more. I think that was the worst than the other. All right, I'll wear the emblem. Just one shoe? So
where's the one you don't want?
That's right. I hope it's the one that you want to daven by. So that's what they want. But they weren't too successful in order for the church to get their policy out, you have to have the cooperation of the government, of the leaders, of the king, of the princes. And if you didn't have that, then, you could make all the decrees you want. And in Poland, they really did not have, at least in the way back then, they did not have that decree. As a matter of fact, Poland was one of the last, it was the last nation to become Christian. I forgot when. It was something that, some sort of a wedding. I think it could have even been in the 1300s, even after this time. The church was there, but the country itself was not, the king himself was not a Christian. And therefore, okay, you got Christians there, you have rights too. Jews, they have rights also as well. Okay, 1332, King Casimir. King Casimir the Great, also he expanded all those decrees that Boleslaw came, and he even expanded them and gave them more rights. And that led to more Jews coming in the 1330s. They went east of Poland, and you started going in other cities, Lvov, Sandomierz, Kazimierz, and Krakow. Now, Kazimierz is today what we would call Krakow. Actually, Kazimierz is really swallowed up by Krakow. Anybody here been to Europe? Anybody here been to Poland?
That's the Galicia.
Kazimierz is really...
That's all Galicia, all the cities.
Okay, right, so... Right, but just Kazimierz is Krakow. When you go to Krakow today, they show you the Ramaz Shul, and they show you that cemetery where all the people are buried in. That's really Kazimierz. Mm. It used to be an island. It used to be separated by water, but it dried up. It dried up from the Megali Amukos, if I think it was, if I had that correct. There was a child that was drowned in there, and I'm not sure if it was that the Goyim took a Jewish child and drowned it, or there was a child that was a non-Jew that was drowned, and they wanted to blame it on the Jews. So the Megali Amukos went to the river, and he said to the river, I'm decreeing against you, do not ever drown a child, or else. And sometime afterwards, it happened again, another child was drowned. And the Megali Amukos went and he said, I told you not to do it. And that's it. After that, it dried up. So today, you can go down one of the streets, they show you this big, wide, wide open like street. It was really, and you see it's like a lower a little bit. It was originally part of the river, so it dried up. So originally, Kazimierz was an island that was separated from the main Krakow, but it dried up. So instead of going around this way, it only went around the other way. So instead of going all four ways around, all right, just so something to, when you go to Krakow, they tell you this, they show you how. But Kazimierz has started then. So this is going to be a major city, a major place where the Jews are going to be, including the Ramah himself. Okay, this is where Poland is around the 1300s. It looks a little different. They're, you know, expanding and losing from when it did in the 1100s. Just also take a look at Germany. You see all Germany is hundreds of principalities. They're all small. Some of them are bigger. Some of them you had the cities. This is the from the emperor. He had emperor cities, but basically it was a whole conglomerate of different princes, about 300. Italy also was, at least North Italy, also cities, city-states. Okay, Poland, this is again what it looked like in 1350. King Kazimir comes, he's very friendly to the Jews. He actually got a name for himself as King of the Serfs and the Jews. He said under penalty of death, kidnapping Jewish children for making them into Christians. Evidently, if he had to make such a decree, that means it must have been happening, right? I mean, like, you're not going to make a decree, nobody hold people upside down if people aren't holding people upside down. Whatever you're doing, he had to make such a decree because things were happening. So it may have been common for Jewish children to be kidnapped, forcibly baptized, and that's it. The kid's a Christian, and the church would treat the kid as a Christian, not give him back, or who knows what. And there were popes throughout the ages. Some of them said, do not forcibly convert Jews, and some said it was okay. So different attitudes of the church had changed throughout all the years. In 1348, even during his time, things started, like, for the Jews overall, it was getting harder. I guess the overall, culture of the Jews was not doing well, even though he himself was a very big protector and friend of the Jews. In 1348, which is the year of the Black Plague, there was the blood libel. In 1367, there was a pogrom in Poznan. However, this is nothing compared to what was going on in Europe. Europe during this time, from the mid-1300s to the 1400s, it was, come on, no Jews in Germany. I mean, very, very few here and there, but they were exiled, they were chased out, they were killed, and it was really almost nothing. And it's to the credit of those Rabbanim that were there in the 1400s, mid-1400s, that a century later in the 1500s, Germany is back as a Torah center. Like, in 100 years, Germany built itself back up. But while this is happening, they're all going to Poland. The Black Plague, for whatever reason, really did not make it to Poland. They were spared of the Black Plague. You know, overall, just never reached there. Reached Germany, reached different places. But overall, Poland was spared of the Black Plague. Okay, this is probably. I think this may have been when Poland became Christian, but I'm not sure. There was a marriage of Władysław to Jadwiga. Now Jadwiga was the daughter of King Louis of Hungary. And the Władysław was the king of Poland, and for somehow when this marriage took place, so now for the first time you're going to have a combination. You're going to have a one sort of kingdom of Poland and Lithuania. I don't exactly know. Didn't become one country, but they were really like two countries, but like the border was blurred. And it just became sort of one administered country, although Lithuania remained Lithuania and Poland remained Poland. Now, I guess this is what it looked like. This was Poland and this was Lithuania. But I think Hungary was also part of it at this time. So now you had a real around, I don't know if it's 1500s or 1400s, but you had a real sizable country. But again, during this time now, Lithuania and Poland are now really one country. To that point where all of the rights that were in Poland now are going to go to Lithuania. So now Lithuania and Poland, Jews are going to move. They were probably moving there as well, but all of the everything that was happening in Poland is now extending to Lithuania. In 1386, this is what they passed a charter of Jews of Lithuania. And this was some of the charters. This is some of the things that were in the charter. The city's magistrate is not allowed to sit in judgment in cases involving litigation between two Jews. Now, the Jews are able to go to Beis Din. If a Christian murders a Jew, he should be punished in accordance with his crime without mercy, and his property should be confiscated by the state. I guess in other places, if Christians killed Jews, they did not suffer from, they were not punished by the law. If a Christian hits a Jew but does not kill him, he shall be punished in the same manner as if he had struck a member of the nobility, which is, you know, I don't know if you struck a Christian if you were like part of the nobility, but if he struck a Jew, so this is like showing that you really that you're protecting your Jews. Jews, same as nobility. One is not allowed to harm a Jew who is traveling from place to place. The tax to be levied on a Jew's merchandise shall not be more than that which is levied on other citizens of the city. I guess this was common. Jews would go from place to place. There would be two different taxes. For a Jew, they would tax him more. They would get more money from him. This was not to be allowed in Lithuania. Again, 1386, when this arrangement came. No tax should be levied for transporting the dead from place to place. I guess the Jews would bring them to their cemeteries, and they have to transport. One who attacks a synagogue shall pay a fine to our magistrate of, get this now, this is big, 2 liters of pepper. Okay, so I guess, you know, for 2 liters of pepper you could buy a shoe. I don't know, like at least you have to pay a tax for destroying the shoe. I guess you could see either they liked pepper or pepper was hard to come by, but the idea is that attacking a shul is going to cost you. The rabbinic court of Jews shall convene in the synagogue or any other place of their choice. They can go, they can meet anywhere. They're not forced to meet in this building or here. One who kidnaps a Jewish child shall be punished in the same manner as any kidnapper, .. It is forbidden to accuse Jews of a crime.
It's
of...
only a child, though.
Huh?
It doesn't say anything about...
Right, it doesn't say anything about... Oh, it does. Kidnaps a Jewish child shall be punished in the same manner as any kidnapper.
Only Jewish child. Doesn't say anything about a Jewish adult.
Right. Okay, I don't know if you'd call... Well, we call everything kidnapping, but... Okay. It was more common to kidnap children, but that's why. It is forbidden to accuse Jews of a crime of killing a Christian child in order to eat its blood, for it is clear that it's forbidden to Jews eat any form of blood. This is just like... You know, this is, again, documents of privilege and rights granted to the Jews of Lithuania by Duke Withold in 1386, when... And this is the year, this is when the Jews of Poland and Lithuania became part of the same king. Okay, there were pogroms and blood libels, 1349. There was in many of the towns in Silesia, the accusations of blood libels against Jews in Poznan in 1399. In Krakow, there was a priest led riots of blood libel. The royal guard stopped it. The Black Death led to additional other outbreaks of violence, and traitors and artisans jealous of Jews supported harassment. In 1423, they forbade Jews from granting loans against letters of credit or mortgage and limited their operations exclusively to loans of security and movable property. So in the 1400s, there were certain things, certain jealousies and certain things of the Jews that their rights were being restricted, not so much by the king, but by the populace. They... Okay, 1454. Now, this person, John of Capistrano, he is infamously known as one of the biggest anti-Semites, probably the biggest causer of Jews being killed, was John of Capistrano. And he used to go from place to place, and he would rile up the cities to go ahead and kill the Jews. And he went through all through Germany. And he did this in the 1450s. And it was almost like no stopping him. Along the path that he took, just about every city, the Jews were had to leave, expelled, killed. He tried. He was invited to go to Krakow, but and other cities, but he did not have the same effect. I thought I had here. Yeah, I just want to show you where Lower Silesian is and Silesian. So this is where Capistrano came. He came again. This is Germany, and he comes from Germany to Lower Silesian, southwest of Poland. I think Krakow is like here. Okay, Krakow is towards the south. More towards the east. This is where Warsaw is up here. So he, after he was successful here against the Jews, they tried to help them out in other towns, but that didn't work. He wasn't as successful. 1495. Now the Jews were allowed to settle in the Jewish town of Kazmir. So this is he actually had them. Leave Krakow and settle there, because you know, again, I guess the world by the Jews were they were being thrown out of in 1492 of Spain. So then I guess it had an influence all over, and in Poland he put them out of Krakow and into Kazimierz. So Kazimierz was like a Jewish suburb, like, you know, probably the Borough Park of its time. They were allowed. So also for in Lithuania, they were banned for a number of years, allowed back in 1503. This is a last name of kings. I don't know how to say it. Jagiellon. But this was the names of kings, a line of kings that were overly pretty good for the Jews. Okay, then came things get during this time, this short amount of time, things are just getting the things are coming out against Jews. The statue of Nisawa, abolished, that the Jews, they don't have ancient rights, and they wanted to take that away from them, although the king was always protecting of the Jews. Okay, Kazimir the Fourth, afterwards, after this came out, he said, "That's it. I can't be this way. I can't stop my benevolence to the Jews." So even though maybe the parliament or whoever, the people were coming out with laws or the princes, laws against things against the Jews, but Kazimir himself, he said, "That's it. I'm going to treat the Jews like everybody else." The policy of government towards the Jews of Poland. So Kazimir's sons, John Albert and Alexander, that sort of went back and forth. Eventually, what's going to happen is that this is his Kazimir the Fourth. He says, "King of Poland, Grand Duke of Lithuania, and all these other places, that a delegation of Jews came before us and explained to us they've been under royal protection as a result of the document. Okay, and therefore it's our desire that the Jews who are protected also enjoy the fruits of success of our kingdom for our good and the good of our treasury. We hereby confirm and substantiate those previously issued privileges." So even though they wanted to take the privileges away, the king said, "Absolutely not. The Jews deserve the privileges." Okay, this is in the 1400s to 1492. The beginning of the 1500s, like right around this period, right around from King Kazimir the Fourth, till Tach V'Tach, which is 1648-1649, is the golden era of Spain. They already have established Jewish cities, and the kings are now going to going to allow the Jews full reign, freedom. The Jews are going to be very wealthy. They're going to establish themselves, and they're going to establish Torah. It's going to be totally a society based on Torah from beginning to end. In 1503, give them the rights to dwell in cities as they originally did. So King Alexander, originally, before he was king, was policy-wise was not so good to the Jews, but after he became king, he reversed himself. All the Palatine's noblemen citizens who borrowed money from them should return them all back. This was King Alexander in 1503. Sigisma. Now he's going to have two sons. After Alexander, there's going to be two sons. There's Sigismund I and Sigismund II. I don't know why I have Sigismund II over here. But Sigismund II followed his father, and Poland became more tolerant. And now, as Jews are being expelled 1492 from Poland and Germany, it's the same type of expulsions from town to town, and everything from all these other places, people are going to Poland. Poland is a haven. It is a very good haven for the Jews. Indeed, Poland became a recognized haven for exiles Western Europe. Okay. And by the, again, Document of Privileges, again, this is Cosme IV. I may have said this. Oh, this, I did this already. Enjoy the fruit success of our treasury. Sigismund I and Sigismund II all granted autonomy to Jews. They could do their own rules, their own, you know, their own everything. Make their own takanas, their own laws among themselves, their own religion, everything. This already we have here. I'm just going to go back later to discuss the Council of the Four Lands, the Vad Arba Arzos. And this was a council of the four lands, whether it was Lithuania, Greater Poland, Lesser Poland, Volyn, which is in the Ukraine. So all of them, they used to get together once or twice a year at the fairs in Lublin, and they used to administer all the Jews in Poland, make takanos, and take care of other things. In the middle of the 1500s, this is wild, that they say about 3/4 of all the Jews in the world lived in Poland. Well, let's see, they were kicked out of Spain, they were kicked out of England, they were pretty much, France. They ran out of, kicked out of France, Germany, they were pretty much all out. So you had the Mediterranean basin, Turkey, which was becoming a major empire. It's not going to reach its zenith until the 1580s, but so it could be that they say that 3/4 of the Jews were in Poland. It definitely became the main center of the yeshivas, and from that time on. In 1503, the Polish monarch appointed as the official rabbi Rav Yaakov Palach. I hope we're going to come back and go through the Rabbanim. And by the 1550s, confirmed Rav Yaakov Palach as chief rabbi of Krakow and all of the Jewish communities because of his great knowledge in Hebrew studies and as well as they are required to obey him and honor him as head of the community as the ultimate authority in legal decisions in the Jewish community. This is confirmation of Rav Yaakov Palach, the office of chief rabbi of Poland by King Alexander. So originally, it was the king that set the rabbi, the first rabbinate, what they call it in Israel, the chief rabbi of Poland. You know, the first one was Rav Yaakov Palach. Interesting stories about Rav Yaakov Palach. I don't know what happened here. What did I do? Where am I? Okay. This is going... By 1551, the Jews were given, that's about 50 years later, the Jews were given permission to choose their own Rabbanim. Okay, so Polish government... The Jews could do their own. Now, the chief rabbi held power over laws and finance. Now, here's also fascinating. The Polish government permitted the rabbinate to grow in power and use it for tax collection purposes. Now, they collected money. Only 30% of the money raised by the rabbinate served Jewish causes. The rest went for protection.
It's worth it.
That's it. Yeah, I guess so. Listen, but you see, when the Jews are making money, everything is working well, and that's the key. The key is that there's money to be made, and once there's money, you could afford giving 70% back to the government and living on the 30%, and everybody has enough. You know, it must have been the amount of money that they must have had was tremendous. Maybe it could be the taxes weren't that much, so whatever they collected, they sent most of it. Is really, that also could be. I'm not sure. Okay, another proclamation by King Sigismund in 1564. Anyone who accuses a Jew of killing a Christian child or desecrating the sacred wafer. This is the what they call it. This is the Christians. The church came out with this thing where the wafers, where the wine is the blood of Yashka, and the wafer is his body, and people were eating it or disgracing it, and they blamed the Jews for it. Why the Jews would do it? How they would break into a church in the middle of the night when they're not even allowed out of their cities, the houses or places. All right, but Kasha Lamaisa, but they would blame Jews, and Jews would be killed. Pogroms would start because of this. And so here, Sigismund comes up and he says, if you anyone accuses a Jew of killing a Christian child, desecrating the sacred wafer, cannot bring it to any nobleman, magistrate, lord, governor, any official. The Jew has to remain free. You can't lock him up until he's brought to the royal court. So, because they knew that these courts are all biased, they're all biased with Christian, and they know how that's all going to end. So the government said, these types of courts, if he really did it, you bring it to us and we'll take a look at the evidence. Now here's something also. If he accuses a Jew, now the Christian has to bring three Christian witnesses, and three Jewish witnesses that the Jew did something wrong. If he fails to produce such witnesses, he shall be severely punished. His blood will be spilled and his property confiscated. So I guess this is if a Christian falsely accuses a Jew of doing, taking the wafers or the blood, taking the blood of a child, and he can't bring all these witnesses, he himself is going to be killed, and that's it. All his money is going to be taken. Okay, again, this is from King Sigismund. This is also something. King Sigismund and King. This is King Ivan. We know him as Ivan the Terrible. So the Poland and Russia at the time. So they had a treaty. I don't know if it was a battle, but they had an understanding, a treaty between the two. And part of the treaty was that our merchants are allowed to do business in your country, and your merchants are allowed to do business in our country. And basically, the Russians did not allow the Jewish merchants in to do business. And this is a letter of Sigismund saying, it's not fair, you are violating the pact, you are violating the treaty. Now, the reason why the Russians didn't allow this is because a few years earlier, probably it could be 100 or 2 years earlier, there was a diplomat, a Jewish diplomat. I don't remember if he was from Italy or... And he was a frum guy, and he came to Russia, and he converted a lot of people. And he actually had a tremendous following, including the daughter or the wife of the czar or whoever was there, whatever he was called back then. And eventually the Russians had enough of it and just killed everybody who was involved in this. So they put an end to it. But they were afraid of Jews because if we let Jews in, the next thing you know, we're all going to become Jewish. So... That's one of the reasons why the Russians did not allow. We have informed you of the evil deeds of the Jews. That's what he's referring to, who are turning our people away from Christianity. How can we permit the Jews to enter our land? And this is part of the exchange of letters that went back in the 1550s. Okay? Now, when Sigismund II died, so they decided that he died without an heir, no children. So now, what are you going to do? So they decided from this point on, the kings of Poland are going to be elected. And that was a new change. In the nobles are going to get together and they're going to elect a king. It's going to continue. The benevolence of the Jews are going to continue all the way through for the next over 100 years, even more. Now, this is a sefer taken from the Yavin HaMetzula, written by Benassan Natan Hanover. And really, he was writing this about the Gzeret Tachvatat. This is the Chmelnytsky's uprising. And he writes horrific stories, just terrible, all the things, the tragedies that happened. But before he writes, this is what life was in Poland before the before these massacres. And just amazing what, like, you know, halavai, we should have like half of this, what went on. Poland, he writes, this is Rav Nosson Nata. Poland, pillar of Torah, there is no need to offer proof for something that is common knowledge. There was never so much Torah learning throughout all of the diaspora of Israel as in the land of Poland. Every single community had supported a yeshiva. They would give sufficient support to their Rosh Yeshiva so they would be able to conduct the studies without financial worry, so that the study of Torah would be his sole occupation. Again, everybody has money. They, you know, almost this we sort of today yeshivas are supported, you know, with Baruch Hashem, you know, with the affluent community, American community, so you could support this. The Rosh Yeshiva would never leave his home throughout the year except to go to and from the Beis Medrash and the Beis Knesset. He would sit there day and night and would be involved only in Torah study. Every community would support Bachrim. These were the oldest students and would provide them with a fixed weekly income so they would be able to study with the Rosh Yeshiva. So you're paying the Talmidim to study also. They would also give each Bachur two younger boys to teach. I guess that's how it worked. You had the older boys learning with Rosh Yeshiva, but these older boys were in charge of younger boys and training them, teaching with them as well. You know, teach them to articulate Gefes. Now, Gefes is an acronym of Gemara, Perish, and Tosus. I think Perish is Rashi. So Gemara, Rashi, and Tosus that he studied, and in order to become accustomed to Pilpul. Now, we're going to talk about this too, but it was a very common style of learning in Poland, which was Pilpul, which was really like an intellectual pursuit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was like to an extreme, and it went like very far off, and many of the Gdolim said that's not what real learning is, you know, building castles in the sky, or you're making inferences before you really understand the Gemara. But intellectually, it had people like, you know, using their minds and opening their minds and coming up with these brilliant, structures of learning, and it's very stimulating, you know. Today in yeshivas also, you can get a Rebbe that can get up there and ask a kasha to the boys, and the boys will give an answer, and he'll, like, you know, back and forth, the questions back and forth, and it's very stimulating, very exciting. You know, unfortunately, if, you know, you only do that, then the boys don't get grounded how to read a Gemara. You know, so the Rosh Yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael of the Beis Medrash are saying, you're sending us boys, I can't read. You know, I don't know how bad the problem is, but, you know, that's not the exciting part. You know, breaking your teeth to read inside is not easy. It's not fun, but it's necessary. If all you know how to do is think logically and come up with these svaras, it's very hard to get grounded. So here, that's what they were doing. That was a type of learning in Poland also, that they weren't getting grounded in the basics, and they're starting to learn, you know, different working on svaras. If the community consisted of 50 householders, balabatim, they would support at least 30 bachrim and boys. One bachur with two boys would stay at the home of a householder, so they would have three people, you know, in the house. At the very least, the bachur would eat on a regular basis at his table like one of his family. Even though he had a stipend, they usually wouldn't charge him. Some of the generous householders would treat the boys like members of their own family and provide all three of them with food and drink throughout the year. There was almost no home in Poland where Torah was not learned. Either the householder was a scholar, or his son or son-in-law was scholars, or the bachur was a member of his household. Sometimes all of the above together existed. They fulfilled, there's a Gemara in Shabbos, that Ravis says, he who has compassion for Rabbanim will have children that will be Rabbanim. He who honors rabbis will have son-in-laws that are rabbis. And he who is in awe of rabbis will himself become a rabbi. That is why there are many scholars in every single community. In a community of 50 households, there were 20 scholars who had the title Morenu or Chaver. The Rosh Yeshiva towered above them all. And all of the scholars were subservient to him and would go to him and study in the yeshiva. Every community of the yeshiva was highly honored. Whether he was rich or poor, they followed him. No one lifted a hand or foot without his permission. Whatever he decreed became law, he had the power to inflict corporal punishment and public shame. Even still, they loved the Rashiva. If one would have a choice piece of food, such as a chicken, he would give half of it away to the Rashiva. They would constantly honor him with other gifts as money, silver, gold, etc. In the shul, most people would vie for the honor. They would buy the aliyah to give it to the Rashiva. The Rashiva had chiyav, or the chiyav for shlishi. That was his. On Shabbos and at least the first day of Yontif. If the Rashiva was a Kohen or a Levi, okay, he got that. And this was the case even though there were many Kohanim and Leviim. No one left the shul on Shabbos or Yontif. I guess you just picture the scene. This is how he's describing the scene of what it was in Europe. Nobody left the shul on Yontif until the Rashiva first departed, followed by his student body of his yeshiva. Afterwards, the rest of the community would leave and escort him all the way to his house. Before Yontif, everyone would walk over to his house in order to welcome the approach of the Yontif. The great honor for the Rashiva would serve as an incentive for all scholars who would constantly devote themselves because they could be a Rashiva too. And just basically he says, Mitok Shalol Lishma, Baal Lishma. That's, he would write. No man left in the morning to his business without hearing words of Torah delivered by a scholar. That's Kol Boker, I guess. Whether it would be Rashi's commentary to the Torah, Navi, Mishnayis, okay, everybody studied whatever they wanted. The Jewish academies, they had Lublin, Krakow, Breslov, Ostrog, other towns. Okay, Poland, Lithuania was the only country in Europe. Okay, so they were farmers as well. Okay, I think that's basically what I wanted to do. I guess next week I'd like to start with ended off. A little bit about the scholarship. Now we're going to see how the learning was different. Rabbi Yaakov Pollack, how he came in, certain wild incidences that happened there, and the Torah learning that was throughout Poland, and some of the Gedolim, including Rav Moshe Isserles. All right, any questions or? Okay.
Sure.
All right, thank you so much.